The Federal Election Commission will reconvene. Before I introduce the panel, I wanted to welcome a special guest today, Mr. Jared Bowman, who's in the back of the room somewhere. Where is he? Oh, there you are. You're in the front. Thank you for coming. Jared is a senior at Woodstream Christian Academy, and he's writing a paper on Citizens United. So he came here today to see how things develop in the good old federal government. I asked him if he was interested in testifying this morning, and he said not just yet. So maybe he'll send us his paper. We look forward to reading it. Welcome. The second panel consists of Jan Baron on behalf of the United States Chamber of Commerce, Lawrence Gold on behalf of the AFL-CIO, and Allison Hayward on behalf of the Center for Competitive Politics. As with the prior panel, each witness has 5 minutes to make an opening statement. And the balance of the time is reserved for questions from the commission and from council and the staff director if they have questions. Once again, we'll go alphabetically. Mr. Baron, you're first. Thanks.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm pleased to appear today on behalf of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which in 2012 is observing its 100th anniversary. The chamber was created at the behest of President William Howard Taft to advocate for free enterprise in America's businesses. Today, the chamber has over 300,000 direct members and indirectly represents more than 3 million companies and professional organizations throughout the United States. As many of you know, the chamber has been active in lobbying and politics and has vigilantly defended its and its members' rights to engage in such activity. As part of its efforts to defend free speech and association, the chamber has participated directly or as amicus curiae in virtually all Supreme Court cases pertaining to campaign finance laws. It filed a brief in Citizens United versus FEC, which was cited by the court in its opinion. The written comments submitted in this proceeding focused on four proposals in the notice of proposed rulemaking. In summary, the chamber urges the commission to adopt alternative A of proposed section 114.2B2I. This alternative recognizes that all expenditures that are independent of a candidate are not subject to any limit or prohibition. This distinction is supported by the statute, the Constitution, and Supreme Court precedent. Second, the chamber opposes the imposition of a generic solicitation notice as proposed in section 114.10C of the notice. Such a requirement is not supported by the campaign finance statutes, nor is it practical. Third, unlike many other commenters, the chamber urges the commission to retain in some form the so-called functional equivalent express advocacy definition contained in current regulation section 114.15. This definition has continuing relevance with respect to the section 109.21, which pertains to coordinated communications. We believe that others who have commented on section 114.15 may have overlooked its use in that regulation. Finally, we agree with the proposed deletions of other regulations that purport to prohibit independent express advocacy. These provisions are contrary to the Citizens United holding. However, we suggest that the Commission also make it clear that public communications that do not contain express advocacy are not subject to reporting obligations. This assumes, of course, that the communications are not electioneering communications as well. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I hope to be able to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Mr. Gold?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appear here on behalf of the AFL-CIO, the National Labor Federation, comprised of 57 national and international unions representing 12 million working people throughout the United States in virtually every occupation and industry. They are all of the affiliates of the AFL-CIO, and there are thousands of local and statewide affiliates or labor organizations within the meaning of the statute. Members of those unions are also members of the AFL-CIO under the Commission's regulations. We commend the Commission for finally issuing an NPRM and holding a hearing in order to conform its regulations to various legal developments. We think it's very important that the regulations comply with the law so as not to confuse or chill those who are regulated and not to maintain what could be traps for the unwary. So we appreciate the opportunity to appear here. I'd like to cover briefly two points that are explained in more depth in our comments. One has to do with the questions about solicitation, and the other about voter registration and get-out-the-vote activities. The NPRM asks whether the current provision in 114.10F for qualified nonprofit corporations should be extended to unions as well as corporations. Such a requirement would be a very big deal, and we do not believe that the Commission has statutory authority to do so. The statute does address solicitations in other circumstances, 441BB3B and C, as well as 441BB4, 5, and 6. And in our view, where the statute does not address solicitation, the Commission does not have authority to invent a new standard for the content of solicitations. Most specifically, one of those provisions does provide already, as Mr. Trister pointed out, that a separate segregated fund must, in fact, notify those who are it's soliciting for a contribution of the political purposes of the fund. A proposal, a more extended proposal that would affect unions and other organizations, what would it apply to? The proposal, the question has to do with donations. Would that apply to dues from union members, agency fees from non-members who are represented, referral fees in hiring hall situations, per capita taxes within labor organizations, that is the portion of dues that goes from a subordinate body to a higher body in the hierarchical structure. If such a solicitation rule were applied to any of these matters, it would disrupt really very highly regulated and sensitive labor management relations and internal union relations that are already subject to extensive regulations dating back to the 1920s, National Labor Relations Act, the Railway Labor Act, the Labor Management Reporting Disclosure Act, comparable analogous statutes dealing with public employees at both the federal and state levels, and would be extremely disruptive. I think also as a constitutional matter to require all organizations when they solicit dues and the like from members presents a very serious constitutional issue of compelled speech. Most organizations, the fact is, just don't do and won't be doing independent expenditures and electioneering communications, and for them to be telling people that their funds might be used for those purposes would be wildly inaccurate. The policy rationale also for extending what is now an MCFL requirement to unions as a whole is really lacking. MCFLs, by definition, exist only to express their only expressed purpose is the promotion of political ideas. That, of course, is not the case with unions, which, as the statute itself recognizes, have a purpose of dealing with employers on wages, benefits, working conditions, and the like. The NPRM suggests that, and I'm quoting, ensuring that those solicited have the information necessary to make informed decisions about how their donations might be used is a value that might be promoted by such a regulation, and it ties that to the affirmation of disclosure and disclaimer requirements by the Citizens United decision. But those statutory provisions dealt with communications and not fundraising, and while that is certainly a virtuous goal, what the NPRM suggests, we believe that if that is going to be applied to unions, as well as other groups for that matter, that's really a legislative question and not an agency question at this point. On voter registration and GOTV, the Act nowhere restricts unions' engagement in voter registration and get-out-the-vote activities. It confirms that unions can do nonpartisan voter registration and GOTV among their members. Your regulations clarify that includes express advocacy, and the regulations have long recognized in particular circumstances that unions can engage in such activities with respect to the general public. But there are also some kind of odd rules that have existed now for well over 30 years, including that a union cannot direct voter registration, GOTV, primarily among those who are registered with a particular political party in the public sphere. Now is a good time, I think, to be looking at these rules in the wake of what's transpired over all those years. We are concerned that any rules that purport to interfere with union communications with their members in these areas would be disruptive. They're not supported by the statute. Of course, unions can coordinate those kinds of activities with candidates. And as the CIO decision remarked a long time ago, those internal relationships and communications are of great constitutional significance. The proposal, however, the NPRM suggests that there are a certain, maybe a classification of voter registration and GOTV expenditures that are subject to restriction, whether they are internal or external, and we would submit that unions are free under the Act to undertake these activities either internally or externally, so long as they are neither coordinated with a candidate or a political party, nor comprise an in-kind contribution otherwise. We think that's what the statute means. It's an important component of our freedom of association, and we believe that that should be recognized. Finally, there are in the years since these rules were adopted by the Commission, there's been a lot of legislation federally and at the state level that deals with voter registration in particular. The National Voter Registration Act, the Help America Vote Act, there are a lot of state laws about this, and the Commission really, I think, in some respects, ought to give way to these other regulatory bodies and focus on the lines that the Act itself imposes. So with that, I appreciate your attention. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. Ms. Hayward?
Yes. Coming now as the fifth person to talk about this notice, I find that perhaps most of what I'm going to say is repetitious, but nonetheless, I will say it. I guess the observation I would make, when I first looked at the two alternatives, is just how it struck me as how ironic would it be for the consequence of Citizens United to be that communications, that is, ads about candidates, were somehow more constitutionally protected than voter registration and get-out-the-vote activity. You know, if we learn nothing from the civil rights movement, it is that voting activity and get out the vote is very important to many communities, and hugely consequential in our enterprise of self-government. And the fact that that would be sort of a consequence of Citizens United, I thought was just mind-blowing and wrong. The fact that there's a communications word sitting around in the statute when we're talking about independent expenditures, that's an artifact of the way the statute developed. It's not something that drives your analysis, and you and your staff should not be distracted by it. The touchstone now, it seems to me, isn't anything like whether or not there's communication involved in the sort of way that we think of electioneering and independent expenditure ads, but whether there's coordination. Because the distinction that still is hugely important is whether or not something is an expenditure or a contribution. How do you know? Well, coordination is one of those places where you find that. To the extent that coordination is difficult to understand, to the extent that the test might be confusing to people, that's a bad thing. But that's the line we care about now. So, in short, corporations and unions can solicit, facilitate, all those other verbs, provided it's independent. Again, I guess one other observation I'd make that may be slightly different is that, this bifurcation of speech and sort of conduct, that was argued in Buckley v. Valeo, and in fact the Court of Appeals sustained contribution and expenditure limits based on the fact that they were activities that might have had some communicative content but were largely conduct. They use the O'Brien test, which is the, if you've got behavior and you're regulating the behavior and you're not regulating based on the communicative qualities of the behavior, then you're okay. The First Amendment would allow that. Well, the Supreme Court rejected that whole O'Brien analysis in Buckley. And, there's several paragraphs. If you want to go back and read them, I will recommend them for your bedtime reading. It still requires exacting scrutiny to regulate political activity. because, in fact, you are going after conduct because of its communication. It's political. And so, you know, the notion that there's somehow communications and non-communicative stuff and that that's a worthy distinction is not a new question. It was a question that was raised and rejected in 1976. And with that, I think I will leave it for now. I won't recite other things in my letter because you can read those for yourself. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yeah. Vice Chair Weintraub.
I thought you wanted to start, Madam Chair. I was waiting for you.
Oh, sorry.
I actually do have a couple of comments and questions. Thank you to the panelists for their comments and for coming in. Welcome back to the ninth floor, Ms. Hayward. I particularly appreciated CCP's comments on how we should try to write simple, clear regulations, and in particular, we should avoid reliance on the word person, which apparently is not a clear term, I assume because most sentient, thinking, breathing human beings would not interpret person to include corporations and labor organizations. And I only wish you had filed that comment with the Supreme Court. Because they apparently do think that they're people. I have a question for Mr. Barron. I read something fairly troubling this morning in the newspaper that the chamber seeks to delay public access to the electioneering communications reports that it is required to file, according to disclosure experts. For example, the chamber's practice has been to file hand-printed paper reports, often faxed to the FEC after regular business hours rather than filing reports electronically, as most other organizations do. And I went and checked and saw between February 6th and 9th there was something like $2 million in electioneering communications disclosed by the chamber. And some of them were actually handwritten. It was neat handwriting. And some of them were filed, were quite apparently faxed. Some of them I couldn't tell. But I'd like to ask you about that, Mr. Barron. Is that true, that your client is purposely filing them in an inconvenient fashion to delay disclosure and to delay access to the information?
Well, Commissioner, I'm not familiar with that press report or the facts that you just recited, so I'm not in a position to comment. But I'm glad to discuss that with you after this hearing, if I can get some information or direct you to somebody at the chamber who might be able to help you on that.
What is that germane to what we're talking about here today?
I don't believe that is relevant in any way to the NPRM that was released on December 27, 2011, and that is the subject, as you know, of the hearing. I don't know how Mr. Barron was supposed to be on notice that he was going to be asked a question like that. And I
assume that he had something to do with advising his clients on the reports that they file under the statute. But I understand that, you know, you have excluded certain topics from consideration and apparently are pursuing your plan to ban any discussion. The free speech crowd, once again, is interested in banning discussion of anything that they don't want to talk about today. So let me ask you, Mr. Barron, about something that you did include in your testimony, in your comments. It says in your comments, an organization can facilitate a donor's willingness to provide aid by making a clear statement that the organization is not soliciting contributions earmarked for electioneering communications. Is that the way the chamber does their solicitations?
The chamber prints notices that it does not solicit or accept any earmarked donation or dues or payment and maintains complete discretion over how it budgets and spends its money.
Does it use some of those funds that it receives in response to those solicitations for electioneering communications?
Within their discretion, they may have, yes. But they will not accept any earmarked donations.
I understand. They're not earmarked. I guess my question is that if you I guess my first question is why is that an aid to the organization to say these aren't earmarked for electioneering communications if indeed
they don't say that. They will not accept any donations that are earmarked for any specific program and retain discretion over any of its spending and budgeting.
And why is that? And I guess I'm just trying to understand why does that facilitate a donor's willingness to provide aid?
Why does it facilitate?
Yeah, that's what you said in your comments, that it facilitates a donor's willingness to provide aid by making
aid
a clear statement that the...
I mean, you know, there are people who want to support the chamber who are willing to do so on an undesignated basis. I mean, either through membership dues or financial support.
Well, I understand why the chamber might want to retain discretion over what it does with its money, but your comment says it facilitates the donor's willingness to provide aid by making clear that the organization is not soliciting contributions earmarked for electioneering communications. And I'm not sure, I just don't understand why that would facilitate the donor's willingness.
Well, there may be donors who will not support organizations if they engage in certain activity or accept earmarked donations, and the chamber has made the decision that they don't do that. It certainly has not encumbered any of the support from the business community for the chamber.
Oh, I'm sure it hasn't. I'm just trying to figure out, what the advantage is to the donor of the chamber stating that it's not soliciting contributions earmarked for electioneering communications.
I really can't comment on that any further than I already have.
All right. I noted on your on the forms that you filed that none of the donors who supplied the funds.
Well, just to be clear, I don't file any forms for the chamber. Are you referring to forms filed by my client?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, you're here on behalf of a client. You're the only guy I got here for the chamber. You know, you're here representing the chamber, so I thought I could ask you questions about the chamber.
So that you, the reports you file, I took that to mean me.
I meant you in terms of your client. I apologize. That was unclear. I did. I'm sure you're not the guy standing at the fax machine. That would be a very bad use of the chamber's fund to pay you to do the faxing. I just note that the forms that I did look at don't disclose any of the donors that supplied the funds to make the ad buys that the chamber actually talks about a lot. You know, I've seen a lot of press reports, and the chamber actually brags about all of its ad buys. And it's not clear to me how that's consistent with what the Supreme Court tells us in Citizens United, that with the advent of the Internet, prompt disclosure of expenditures can provide shareholders and citizens with the information needed to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters. Shareholders can determine whether their corporation's political speech advances the corporation's interest in making profits, and citizens can see whether elected officials are in the pocket of so-called moneyed interests. The First Amendment protects political speech, and disclosure permits citizens and shareholders to react to the speech of corporate entities in a proper way. This transparency enables the electorate to make informed decisions and give proper weight to different speakers and messages. The Supreme Court apparently thinks that internet disclosures are fairly important, and maybe you could relay that that section of the opinion to your client, since they're still relying on fax machines, and I'm pretty sure they've got an internet connection and a computer.
I'll be glad to do so, and I'm sure that you can relay your view that there ought to be new laws to enhance disclosure to Congress.
I'm just talking about what the Supreme Court said.
Yeah.
They've already said that.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Commissioner McGann?
Mr. Gold, are unions persons?
Under some provisions of law, they are persons because laws define the term person to include them.
What is a union?
A union is an organization comprised of individuals who voluntarily join and primarily exist as several statutes, including yours, pretty accurately summarize it.
Individuals breathe?
If I may finish. Sure. For the purpose of dealing with employers on wages and conditions of employment. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And those folks breathe? The individuals who form the union?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Barron, let's talk about I'll call it the post-WRTL rule.
and I've read your comments. I alluded to them in the earlier panel. Mm-hmm. And I'm having trouble because on the one hand, the Supreme Court said that wasn't the way to go. On the other hand, I take from your comments, either explicitly or implicitly, that you want to at least have some sort of hash mark so you know the commission can't get carried away with itself. Because as we know, primarily, we've illustrated it here today, some folks get carried away with themselves. So what you're saying is don't let that happen. But given where I come from, how do I thread this needle? Because I don't want to really maintain a rule that seems to be vague and you know, balance of factors and that kind of thing. Can you help us with this?
Yeah, I recognize the dilemma, and I did hear the comments from the earlier panel. The import of our suggestion is to see whether you can salvage something here that would be helpful in the context of your coordination regulations, which refer to the functional equivalent of express advocacy, which of course is there because of another court decision reviewing your coordination regulations. And I recall vaguely being here with Mr. Gold on a coordination hearing once or twice discussing that issue. So if appropriate for this rulemaking, you know, it would be nice, for example, to have the safe harbor at least mentioned in the context of coordination as to what functional equivalent is and is not as a possibility. We just wanted to point out that this distinction does have continuing relevance beyond the regulation at question here at 114.15, and would invite the commission to at least preserve something of it in the coordination rule.
Mr. Gold, does the AFL-CIO have any position on that?
Well, I think we didn't address that, I think, directly in our comments. If 114.15, if the definition, the portion of that, the definition were excised, then 109.21c5 would at least capture the essence of it. The multi-factor test that's in 114.15, which the Supreme Court did criticize 2 years ago, you know, has been around now for, I guess, 3 years or so. It's not what we had advocated. It has some elements, I believe, of what the AFL-CIO advocated. I'm not really sure it's worth revisiting that. I think in reality, in my experience over the last 3 years, it has not been an impediment. And I think the whole issue of defining something that is close to but isn't express advocacy has been bedeviling everybody for a long time. I'm not really sure it's worth the commission going through that exercise again. I see no urgent need for it, and I think I am agnostic about whether it's retained as the chamber has advocated or removed, and we're just left with the essential description in 109.21.
Thank you. Get out the vote. Very important issue here. Particularly when you have this theory going around that somehow the Supreme Court struck the ban on expenditures and electioneering communications and sort of created a donut hole where then there's this other stuff that's not that, that somehow may still be banned, sort of the gist of part of alternative B. To me, that dog doesn't hunt. You know, it really is a rehash of O'Brien, and Buckley rejected that whole thing. But could you help us and tease out a little bit more about what in alternative A is either good or not as clear to ensure that the living, breathing people within the person of the AFL-CIO can participate in politics?
Without necessarily going over the, you know, specifics of alternative A, I'd be happy to address particular language, but I think our main point here is that with respect to get out the vote activities internally, we believe there, you know, the commission just does not have authority to restrict how that is undertaken, and that with respect to external GOTV, If it is not coordinated with a candidate or a political party, and if it is not an in-kind contribution otherwise, unions are free to decide how to deploy those resources and how to communicate with the general public for purposes of GOTV, or even assisting or facilitating their going to the polls and the like. In order to restrict that, there has to be some basis for that in the statute. And there has to be some constitutional way to draw a line, in fact, otherwise. This goes to civic participation, and this is something that the commission ought to be enhancing where there is some discretion as to which way to go. GOTV is, I think, universally viewed as an important factor. I did note, that in the NPRM it mentions some activities, conduct that is all wrapped up in this, there were questions about. And as I pointed out, for example, assisting volunteers, providing food to volunteers, for a candidate, which may involve GOTV activities, in some circumstances it is an in-kind contribution and it is prohibited, and we would not suggest that the commission should be opening that up. But if it is truly independent of a candidate or a political party, it is part and parcel of the statute. Just doesn't regulate it. There are important freedom of association aspects of this, which can't be overlooked. And so, as a general matter, that's why we believe that your final rules ought not to be imposing restrictions that aren't there.
One final question. Dealing with the restricted class versus dealing with the general public and how to report this and the idea of allocation, which makes sense to me. But what I don't hear anyone suggesting is some sort of mandatory minimum ratio a la what was struck in the Emily's List case, right? I think what you're looking for is something that just reflects reality. However you spend the money, you can split it on what the facts dictate. That's the gist I get from not just your comment, but other comments. But could you maybe elaborate on how this affects the AFL-CIO?
Right. Well, I think my partner, Mr. Trister, actually articulated it in a way that I would agree with. We've always viewed this is not a new question. Not entirely new question. After all, when a political committee has done independent expenditures, sponsored by a union, nobody's ever thought that there ought to be some special consideration for the fact that it might reach some members. I think as a practical matter, I would view any kind of mass communication that does not distinguish among recipients that ought to be reportable as a general public communication, whereas the more individualized, pre-planned, targeted communications such as telephone, mail, email, and the like ought to be subject to a reasonable allocation, in some cases a specific allocation. There is a reporting regime for independent expenditures. There is a reporting regime for internal communications. We don't see a problem conforming with both of them where there are communications that apply to both, and especially if in the mass communications area we have the discretion to essentially ignore the fact that some recipients will be members. I don't think there's any other practical approach to it.
Well, if I could just comment on that. And this is not something that the chamber commented on in its submission, but I did hear the earlier panel, and I just heard Mr. Gold. And I want to point out that as a statutory matter, communications, the costs of communications to the restricted class are neither contributions or expenditures. So spending money for that purpose was never subject to the prohibition, isn't regulated as a contribution or an expenditure. And the only reason there's a disclosure element is that it was inserted in the 76 amendments in the Senate, initially by Senator Packwood, to require some evidence or of internal express advocacy of a certain amount that would then be subject to a separate reporting. And I'm not sure that I could go along with a uniform dismissal of public communications not necessarily being communications to the restricted class. There are some major organizations where a majority of the residents of a particular congressional district are members and in the restricted class, more than a majority. And it may be that a public communication, what we would consider a public communication, would be the most cost-effective way of communicating with their own members. And I think that that may require some sort of an allocation and a demonstration of fact that some of the communication went to members and some went to people outside of the restricted class. But I don't think you can summarily say, well, we're going to treat the whole thing as just a public communication and not recognize the fact that certain expenses are neither contributions or expenditures.
Gee, I thought just disclosure was supposed to be easy. So what you're saying is one size fits all doesn't really fit all, right?
I think that's correct.
If we impose some sort of ratio, we could end up either making a mess for someone or politically tilting the scale one way or another, which isn't really what we should be doing. Given that we have to write regs, though, you know, I keep coming back to Mr. Gold because we had a matter, it's public now, where there's some confusion over when they had to report distributing yard signs. Not necessarily Mr. Gold's client, but it was a union. So you get into the weeds of this stuff, it becomes very, very tricky. And what I don't want to do is do a rule that ends up being Emily's List 2. But on the other hand, you don't want it to be completely anything goes, because then you're vulnerable to complaints and people saying, "Well, that's not a reasonable ratio." How do we balance the? How do we do this in a way that allows you to do what you want to do politically, but yet doesn't get in the way from a regulatory point of view? Any thoughts?
Well, the only thing I heard was allocation.
Right. And the key is make sure it reflects the facts, the actual what's spent, not that it's some arbitrary thing. Okay, thank you.
Any questions? Any further questions?
All right, not at the moment, thanks. Okay.
Commissioner Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to thank each of those who are willing to come before the Commission today. Certainly appreciated the thought and the care that went into putting together these comments. And I mean, obviously, the comments and the hearing are a very important part of the process for developing these rules. And I commend you for being willing to be here and to participate in the way that you have. Issue that I wanted to bring up was, I think, raised by both Mr. Gold and Mr. Barron, 114.4C, talking about a list of paragraphs 2 through 6, there's a list of activities that, you know, prior to Citizens United, these were communications to the general public that were permitted by corporations and unions. Mr. Gold, you advocate getting rid of 2 through 6, saying that their retention could lead to greater confusion rather than less. And I was just, if you could kind of flesh that out a little bit.
Well, I think, as I said, you know, it's important that the regulations be clear. Most organizations, including most unions, don't have legal counsel who are expert or available on these matters. The inclusion of certain lists of communications can suggest that they are limited, especially if they're described in particular ways, unless there's a very clear catch-all that basically says, and anything else. And, you know, these rules were written a long time ago. The way that the law treated this and the way the Commission approached these matters, I think, was just very different. So given, you know, legal developments to specify, again, you know, what a voter guide is and to have, you know, particular restrictions on their composition, which clearly, if enforced, would be subject to challenge and overruling by or invalidation rather by a court, does not seem to us to be you know, the best way to go here. So in clarity, I think, is the point. You could have a list, but it would have to be clear that there are, that, you know, other communications are also permissible.
Okay. Mr. Barron, you addressed, you didn't advocate one way or the other about removing those particular paragraphs, but what would your position be on that? Does there need to be a catch-all, or for the sake of clarity, is it easier to just strike those altogether?
I think that it is possible to streamline these and eliminate a majority of these items. However, I do think you have to still honor the statute, which has three exceptions in it, including the one we just discussed about partisan communications. Those are not contributions or expenditures. It says that nonpartisan registration get-out-the-vote campaigns are not contributions or expenditures. That's the statute saying it. And then, of course, the expenses of having a separate segregated fund, those administrative expenses are not contributions or expenditures. So it seems to me that the regulations ought to at least reflect that element of the statute. Everything else, as Larry mentioned, really goes back to the initial rulemakings in the 1970s, where the commission came up with additional variations to allow corporations and unions to engage in certain activity, like these voter guides and so forth. But that really doesn't seem to be as necessary today, now that expenditures, as long as they're independent, are unlimited and may take a infinite variety of forms.
And Mr. Barron, it seems that you are flagged an issue that Mr. Trister did as well on 114.4C, that the NPRM may have sowed some confusion with respect to whether or not there's additional, under Alternative A, whether or not there would be additional reporting requirements for GOTV and voter registration activities that don't contain express advocacy. And just to clarify from my perspective, that was certainly not the intent of the NPRM, but again, appreciate you noting that so that so we can be aware of where the NPRM may have fallen short. Ms. Hayward, I just wanted to ask just one final question. You talked about the speech versus conduct distinction and the difficulties that might arise if we kind of went in a communicative versus non-communicative expenditure direction. Just along those same lines, it seems, at least to me, that most speech has some non-speech element in order to effectuate it, and that any attempt to disentangle that could be a fairly difficult exercise. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on whether or not it even really is theoretically possible to disentangle non-speech expenditures and speech expenditures.
Am I on? I think it's probably not possible in this area anyway, because, you know, all we're doing here is regulating money in politics. But it's money in politics. It's not money in some broader context. Political communications are going to necessarily be communicative. Political activity is going to be communicative. You know, you're not engaged in politics because you don't care who wins. So I don't think here that is possible.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Commissioner Bowerly?
Thank you. I wanted to follow up on what Commissioner Peterson was just discussing about potential challenges of parsing speech. I think in the comments from CCP, Ms. Hayward noted that parsing non-speech might require a fact-specific exercise. And Mr. Gold, I appreciate your treatment of the distinction. You laid out a couple of different ways that this might happen, these activities might happen, and they might consist of speech alone, you say, material assistance alone, and I actually think that's a useful phrase. I appreciate that. Hadn't used that in the NPRM, but I think that's actually a useful phrase. And then some combination of speech and material assistance. And it's that combination that I wonder if that concern about the workability of trying to figure out what which is which. And I wondered if you had any your comments didn't really dive into that. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on the workability aspect of any, if you have those concerns.
Well, I think what we were trying to address was the notion of, you know, expenditures that go beyond speech. And I think it comes back to the point that so long as it doesn't comprise an in-kind contribution of some kind, either because it's a coordinated communication or in part a coordinated communication, or what is happening is, in fact, an in-kind communication, for example, in the form of delivering prospective voters to a campaign headquarters for the campaign itself to gather and bring to the polls. So long as it's neither, then I don't believe that it can be restricted as long as it's done independently among the general public or among one's members. I think that's what the focus was.
Okay. And I appreciate that's what was the focus of your comments. I didn't know if you had any additional comments on the workability aspect that was raised by some other commenters. If not, that's fine.
I'm not sure I do. Thank you, though.
Thank you.
Well, you know, in our comments, we cited the statement from Buckley that certain distinctions may dissolve in practical application, and I think we see this in several court cases that are cited in our written submission, including Justice Stevens's own observation in his dissent, Citizens United, that voting, and I'm quoting him, voting is not speech in a pure or formal sense, but then again, neither is a campaign expenditure. Both are nevertheless communicative acts aimed at influencing electoral outcomes. And throughout the history of Supreme Court litigation on these issues, the court really hasn't itself made a distinction between communicative versus non-communicative expenses. They recognize, for example, when they struck down the limit on candidate spending of his or her own campaign money, that the money is used for a variety of things, communicative and non-communicative, to get an office, to pay salaries, and so forth. But nonetheless, the expenditure limit was unconstitutional because it didn't satisfy First Amendment criteria.
And I think I want to be clear, the policy that you articulated very clearly, Mr. Golden, I think is shared by all of the panelists, of encouraging civic engagement and in helping people to find their way to the polls and do all of those things is certainly a goal that I personally share, and certainly nothing that the Commission or this NPRM was trying to get in the way of. I think as Mr. Gold noted, and as the comments from CCP, there is a question here. It may not be a question for everyone, but there is a question here resulting from the court case, and we're trying to figure out what the line should be. I particularly appreciate CCP's and Ms. Hayward's comment about our job here is to try to make things easier for people. I would love us to engage in a rulemaking where we go through the regulations and try to use real language that normal people, not people who do campaign finance, not that we're all not normal in some sense, but the real world really would understand. I think that would actually be a real benefit that the Commission could try to undertake. I'm not optimistic about that given how long it takes us to do things, but I think that would be a very useful thing for us to do. And so in one of the things that I try to think about is workability, and it seems to me that trying to parse out the material support. I'm driving a voter to the poll, but along the way, I might be discussing the policy positions of that candidate. And then what does the gas mean in terms of, you know, the express advocacy? Because when you get out of my van, I might say to you, and go vote for candidate Smith, because that's who I'm supporting. So those are the sorts of things that I think about when we're trying to figure out how to make our regulations more clear in this area. Well, so I just wanted to, I share the concern about making sure that everyone has the ability to exercise their voting rights. I don't think that anyone would suggest that that's not the goal of the Commission.
I also would urge the Commission not to overlook the associational activities, which also are protected by the First Amendment. So there could be a gathering of people without a word being said, but it's still a protected activity, including driving people to the polls without saying anything. They're trying to associate with others for a certain political purpose.
I guess it might depend on how many people you can fit in a car or if you give bus fare. I mean, these are the complicated problems.
That's why Chrysler invented minivans, you know.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, excellent. Well, thank you very much to Mr. Gold, Mr. Barron, and to Ms. Hayward for coming this morning, and to our previous panel and all those who submitted comments, even if they didn't come in today. It will definitely help us in crafting the rule, which is what we're planning to do, hopefully very soon. I know that this helped me decide a lot of the issues, and thank you for bringing up some of the things that were confusing to you within the NPRM. Just to be on the record, I think, you know, alternative A makes the most sense, and I think the comments clearly support that. I don't know exactly what some of my other colleagues are thinking, but once we get a chance to flesh that out, I think hopefully we'll be able to promulgate a rule on this issue sooner rather than later, I hope. I'd like to thank the Office of General Counsel, and in particular Mr. Herman, Mr. Dealey, Mr. Knopp, who's hiding back there, Ms. Hayden, Ms. Wallstriker, and Mr. Lutz for their help in preparing for this hearing, and the NPRM and the rule that will be helping us craft very soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.